right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Andrew Sachs. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Sarah Flanders. Mr. Chief Justice, I would respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The appellant, Your Honor, Sarah Flanders, was convicted in the Circuit Court of the City of Virginia Beach after a bench trial of hit and run resulting in death and second-degree felony murder accidental, as it's charged. She received a sentence of 2 years for the hit and run, and interestingly enough, 20 years for the second-degree felony murder, the active sentence, so 22 active years, 20 of which was for the accidental alleged second-degree felony murder. This is an appeal from the Court of Appeals of Virginia, the memorandum opinion that was written by the court, dated July 10, 2018. We subsequently moved for a petition for rehearing. That was denied August 20, 2018. A single assignment of error before the court. The question is the sufficiency of the evidence to convict the defendant, the appellant, of second-degree felony murder. This case, I would submit to you, Your Honors, turns on the court's interpretation of Virginia Code 18.2-33, which sets out the Virginia statutory felony murder doctrine, which states the killing of one accidentally, contrary to the intent of the parties, while in the prosecution of some felonious act other than those specified in 18.2-31, which is capital murder, and 18.2-32, which is certain other felonies, is murder in the second degree. Now, the fact in this case, it's not a factually rich record, and that I think that has some bearing on this court's, or should have some bearing on the court's decision. The victim in the case was found lying in a parking lot behind the school by some Dominion Power workers. The defendant, or a driver later identified or found by the court to be the defendant, said, quote, the guy laying back, there's a guy laying back there by the school bleeding from the head. She also said someone had been run over and was bleeding to death and to call 911. The victim himself said that he had been struck or had been hit. The defendant was identified as the driver through circumstantial evidence, although the circumstances of the accident and the death are really not clear. It's clear that the victim was dead or was killed, and clear that the driver is the appellant. And she also said post-accident while in police custody on a video, quote, this was crazy, and she thought he would make it. And because we don't know specifically what happened, I think that has some bearing. Again, I think the court can confine its decision in this case. It doesn't necessarily have to be across-the-board categorical that on these facts, under these circumstances, we can't even say what specifically happened in order to give articulation to the felony murder.
Counsel, the inferences that one can get take from this evidence,
yes, sir,
are pretty clear. I mean, it certainly appears that Durango was used as a weapon. I mean, just happened accidentally?
Well, Your Honor, I understand that. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I remember in the trial court, this issue was addressed at when I made the motion to set aside at the sentencing. The Commonwealth's attorney, I don't know if he directly stated it or certainly implied it, but that's not what was charged. That's not what the court found. The charge is that it was an accidental death.
Well, the issue is, is there sufficient malice or not?
Well, but malice wasn't, the malice, I guess, is implied in this case under the second degree felony murder doctrine, I guess, much less like the first degree with the commission of the act or the occurrence in the commission of a felony. But there was no allegation of actual malice. Now, that would have been a second degree murder, a standard second degree murder case, not relying upon the second degree murder felony murder doctrine. There would be two ways, at least, to pursue second-degree murder or charge it. One would be the straight, conventional, common law, if you will, a malicious killing. That was not alleged in this case. It may be that the Commonwealth thought that, or maybe that was part of their implication, but they chose to charge it as accidental, and I think that's the finding that the court is bound by, and that's what the charge itself was. So I don't think we can depart from that. If it was malice itself, then they wouldn't need the second-degree felony murder doctrine. They would simply allege she intentionally, or she struck him, and she did it with malice. So I don't know if that answers Justice Mims' question, but I think, again, we're confined to the Commonwealth's theory and what the court is bound to. Is there sufficient evidence to establish that in the course of the commission of a felony, as there was an accidental death. And that requires us, Your Honors, I think, to look at more specifically the case law in the Commonwealth on that, because there are a number of cases. It's not a clear question. The memorandum opinion set out, I will concede, set out the correct legal standards, and I'll just read very briefly. This is from the Court of Appeals. To prove a violation of 18233, again, the second-degree felony murder doctrine, the Commonwealth must prove the defendant killed the victim, quote, while in the prosecution of some felonious act or in furtherance of the felony. The killing must be within the res gestae of the predicate felony or so closely related to the felony in time, place, and causal connection as to make it a part of the same criminal enterprise. And then here's, I think, the key qualifying language. It is not enough that the killing occurred during the felony or while it is being committed. So that alone is not enough. Something more is required than mere coincidence of time and place. And it's our position, Your Honors, on this record that that's all we have here, that it would be speculation to go. In fact, it's not just speculation, this is a matter of law, that there is insufficient evidence beyond showing it is a mere matter of time and place.
Well, the Commonwealth makes the argument, I assume relying on our case of Commonwealth versus Montague,
yes,
that not only is this a killing that is within the res gestae of the predicate felony, but also, if that's not sufficient, it is closely related to the felony in time, place, and causal connection to make it part of the same criminal enterprise. But you may be absolutely correct about time and place is not enough because it's conjunctive, and
yes, sir.
The Commonwealth says it's clear that there's a causal connection even if we don't have it within the res gestae.
Well, the Commonwealth, the Montague case, and I'll just, again, I have to be faithful to the rules. It's rather technical, but the felony murder statute applies where the killing is so closely related in time, place, and causal connection as to make it a part of the same criminal enterprise. We agree with that. However, here, as argued, and this is what my position is, such time, place, and causal connections are lacking other than coincidence of an accidental killing that fortuitously occurred at some time in connection with the victim temporarily close to the defendant's appearance at the scene. That's our position. And frankly, Your Honor, in this case, but for if the really the gravamen of this, if you look at it, it's the leaving the scene, because if the defendant struck, and we really don't know what happened. We don't know whether she struck him, he walked in front of her. We just don't know. But what we do know is that if there was a hitting or an accident under the statute, it's the leaving the scene that completes the felony. That's the gravamen of it. It's not the striking. It's not the hitting.
It's the leaving the scene, perhaps, but it's also the failure to render reasonable assistance, which the Commonwealth argues that this felony has not been completed at the time this man is hit. And actually, probably at the time he died.
And I understand, but again, confining it to these specific facts, there's no evidence that if the person had stayed, that it would have made a difference, it would have mattered, and we're speculating. I would submit in that regard. If the defendant had remained at the scene and the victim had still died, there'd be no offense at all. It might be simple. It might be civil negligence. But to transmute something, because the leaving is what, that's when the felony, that's the essence of it. What is the connection between the leaving and the death? I mean, it really is fortuitous.
Can I interrupt?
Absolutely.
You there? So in the res gestae analysis, the causal connection, the time and place connection, all those factors to determine if it's in the cluster of facts,
yes.
It sounds like, if I'm understanding you, you think that a reasonable doubt standard sort of cuts into those equations, and every factor has to be proven by reasonable doubt when I question that. Maybe the aggregate of it all, obviously, if it's res gestae, which is an element of felony murder. But your last point, you know, if a ambulance had showed up at this moment or that moment, do we really need to have sufficient evidence at the level of reasonable doubt for that?
Well, I just think there has to be some evidence that if there's this causal connection that somehow, I mean, if the gravamen is that she should have stayed and that could have saved the person, therefore it turns it into that's a cause of the death, then I think we have to have some evidence of that. We just don't have it at all. I mean, what concerns me about this case, and I two of the justices were on the writ panel, and you may recall this, but This will upend, I submit respectfully, criminal jurisprudence in Virginia, because if our prosecutor, if this court affirms, I don't mean this critically, but the court affirms the Court of Appeals, any prosecutor worth their salt will say every hit-and-run death is automatically a second-degree felony murder. They will have to say it. I mean, that would be the rule. If the rule is, or that would be the law.
But the res gestae analysis is highly fact-intensive.
Well, I agree with you.
And giving the Commonwealth the inferences that they have the benefit of in front of this court, the facts all turn against your client.
Well, that's where, Your Honor, I just respectfully differ. I think there's a lot of speculation. First of all, I get back to this. Maybe it's a basic due process issue, but if the Commonwealth chooses to charge it as accidental, then whether there's some belief that it could be malicious or not, that's not the court's finding, and that's not what the defendant was found guilty of.
But I think what's being asked of you is there can be many fact patterns where the death is pretty attenuated from the actual hit and the actual run. And maybe the death occurs 2 days later or 3 days later, and the prosecution could never make the res gestae win there, could they?
Well, I would argue that that's true, but I'm not sure what the implication of this decision will be. I mean, a prosecutor may say, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it was a day later, 2 days later. It's such a slippery slope. We need a bright line. Either it is or it isn't. If it occurred in the commission of the felony, and the definition is it hadn't been completed, it's hit and run, and they died as a result of it, then you have it. You know, two cases come to mind. These are not in the record, but two that I had recently ended up being guilty pleas in two different jurisdictions. One, a young man distributed heroin they were heroin addicts to a friend. He provided it. The friend overdosed and died. Now, they charged second-degree felony murder. It ultimately was reduced to manslaughter as a plea agreement. But I can understand that. There's a direct relationship. You provided heroin, the person died. It's not just fortuitous. You maybe didn't intend for death, but it was truly closely connected. It wasn't just fortuitous. You could perhaps even foreseeable. The other is a case where a father had a loaded firearm in the house, a 5-year-old son. He fell asleep, didn't supervise the child properly. The child got a hold of the gun and killed himself, an accidental discharge. That was second-degree felony murder as charged and pled guilty to, because there you have a direct connection. The father was neglecting the child got a hold of the gun, and because of the neglect, killed himself. Here, I mean, hit and run is fortuitous. Somebody could be you could be sitting at a stoplight, and a drunk driver hits you, and you get scared and leave. You're guilty of hit and run.
But that's not the facts that we have
here. I understand.
The facts that we have here are much more. Go ahead.
That's right. No. I'm listening. Please.
You're down to 2 minutes and 12 seconds.
I realize
if you'd like to use it, you can use it any way you want.
I don't think your answer is going to convince me differently from where I feel like I am right now, but thank you.
I will
remaining time.
I will take 10 seconds and try. I think that the records, as I go back to the beginning, we don't know what happened here. If we confine it just to the facts, we make it very fact-specific. We have a death, we have a hit, we have a run, but we don't know what happened. We don't know the circumstances, and I think that alone should govern the decision.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Appreciate it.
145.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court did not err in this case in convicting the defendant of felony homicide because the victim's death was within the res gestae of that underlying hit-and-run felony. As we've been discussing, this court adopted the res gestae rule in Haskell, and the court explained what that meant by saying that when a victim's death and the felony are so close in time, place, and causal connection as to constitute a single continuing criminal enterprise, and the death is within the res gestae of the underlying felony. And the Commonwealth's evidence in this case meets all three of those criteria. I believe everyone is on board with the fact that we have a unity in time and place. The hit that formed the basis of the hit and run, if you will, was the action that directly caused the victim's death. Those occurred at the exact same time and place as this felony was taking place. We also have a strong causal connection in this case. That same vehicular accident was the direct cause of the victim's death. That cause is an element of the hit-and-run offense, the first element. So if you view these facts in a continuing sequence, we have the victim and the defendant speaking on the phone at about 3 a.m. We have the victim and the defendant meeting in an empty parking lot about 2 hours later. The defendant strikes the victim, who is a pedestrian, with her large SUV, fatally wounding him, and flees the scene He dies from his injuries, blunt force trauma to the torso, at the hospital about 3 hours later. That is a continuing and unbroken sequence of events, and as such, the victim's death was within the res geste of that underlying felony hit-and-run offense. I think it's significant that defense counsel was speaking about the Commonwealth's charging decision here and whether this was an accidental death versus an intentional death, and it was absolutely the Commonwealth's position at trial. I think you can see that at Appendix 173 and 175, that the collision was intentional. The defendant was acting intentionally when she struck the victim. It doesn't mean that the death was not accidental. I think under other circumstances, I would argue to this court that it was, but we didn't have to prove that in this case, and there's no inconsistency in the way this was charged, but still maintaining that this was absolutely an intentional act on the part of the defendant. And I struggle to find facts in this record that would support anything else when we have an empty parking lot, two people who have a prior relationship, where the defendant has also tried to hit the victim on a bicycle about 2 days prior. They have a conversation that morning, and again, there's only two people in an empty parking lot. One of them is in the car and manages to hit the other person with sufficient force to fracture their pelvis, break multiple ribs, and ultimately have them succumb to blunt force trauma to the torso.
Counsel, let me change the facts somewhat. The hit and run occurs on a residential street. The parties do not know each other. The driver of the car is looking down at a cell phone, hits someone, knows that they have hit an individual, not a deer or something like that, but then continues on. Would those facts fit within the Commonwealth's argument, or are those distinguishable for purposes of the charge that was made?
I think that they are distinguishable, and it would be important if you were a prosecutor making a charging decision on those facts. I think you would have difficulty proving that circumstantially that underlying felony had begun at that point. I think the argument could be made, Your Honor, but I believe it would be a much more difficult argument for the Commonwealth to make under those circumstances when there was no prior relationship between the parties and their, as Your Honor said, maybe there are other reasons for the accident, and it was an accident in the truest sense of the word, maybe in Your Honor's hypothetical. But as the court noted, that is certainly not what we have here. And for those reasons, the kind of parade of horribles as to what will happen to the practice of civil law.
So perhaps the problem, one of the challenges we have is simply that the word accident is imprecise, and there are accidents that are accidental. And there are accidents, as we use that term with regard to motor vehicles, that are in fact intentional acts or appear to be intentional acts.
Yes, Your Honor. And this court has held already, and I believe it's Mizano, it's cited on brief that for purposes of the hit and run statute, of course, we don't care whether the collision was intentional or accidental, because that statute is designed to protect the victim so that help is rendered and information is given. And this court has already held that the word accident in that hit-and-run statute is not truly meaning, as we kind of colloquially say, that there was no intent.
But when a prosecutor files a hit-and-run indictment or pursues a hit-and-run indictment where they could, in theory, pursue a second-degree murder indictment, like in this situation, it's not a concession that it was not intentional. It's just, I don't have to prove it.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm over or understating what you're saying, is when you get into the res geste analysis, even in a pure indictment alleging an accidental assault and battery, you can still look at the entire criminal enterprise, the motive of the defendant, the very circumstances of the hit, without having to demonstrate that the hit was malicious, premeditated, etc. Just to understand if the death was part of that cluster of facts where it's essentially one crime from a layman's point of view.
Yes, and the phrase the court used in Haskell was inextricably interwoven. And I think that statement certainly applies here. These actions cannot be separated from each other, and that the Commonwealth was not held to a higher burden of proof in this case because of its charging decision does not take away from the facts, as the court noted, and this court's ability to consider all the facts as they were proven at trial.
Given your answer to Justice Kelsey's question, I kind of don't understand your response to Justice Mims' hypothetical. I mean, why would it make a difference that the person who perpetrated a hit and run was looking at their phone and they hit somebody who was a stranger as opposed to somebody who ran into someone they knew? What's the difference?
I think, Your Honor, maybe not. I think the difference is when we talk about the continuing sequence of events, and here in this case, what the parties were looking at. That's why I said it would be a harder case. I don't think I could stand here and say, no, the Commonwealth could not charge felony hit and run in that case with the accidental killing there, but I think it would be a harder sell, particularly in light of the Court of Appeals case law talking about when the res geste begins, which is circumstantially determined on the facts of each case. But if we're talking about indictable attempts to commit the felony, we have some unique facts in this case that talk about, that inform us as to what the victim's and what the defendant's intent was here. What the defendant's intent was when she was in this parking lot, when she hit this person, this pedestrian with
her
vehicle.
Well, in particular, why did she run? Did she run because she was scared and she thought she hit a deer or whatever, or did she run because, as far as I'm concerned, he can die right there?
Yes, and in fact, Your Honor, she said to the Dominion workers as she was leaving that that he was bleeding to death, and it looked like he had been run over. And, of course, this court has held that a vehicle can be a deadly weapon. So we have, to answer Your Honor's question, we have unique information about her state of mind in this case that may not be present in Justice Mims' hypothetical about two strangers who are involved in a collision caused by distracted driving. I think that inform the court as to when the sequence of events that charge the felony would begin. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
And it's also apparent here, one of the facts I haven't mentioned yet, is that she didn't want to call 911.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do we know whether she had a cell phone with her or not?
We don't know, Your Honor. However, the victim did have a cell phone on him, and the defendant had spoken to the victim for about 20 seconds, about 2 hours previously. They were in each other's phone contacts. So we don't know whether she had a cell phone, but certainly the victim had a cell phone with him, and she had spoken to him on it earlier that morning. She was also close to her mother's house. There's evidence in the record that the two of them had stayed with her mother in a nearby location. So she's familiar with the location. She's familiar with the victim, who did have a cell phone on him, but unfortunately it was not used to call for assistance there.
So if I understand things correctly, it may be that in this instance, a reasonable fact finder could conclude the res gestae began with a hit in this instance, as opposed to possibly another case where it's a fortuitous, just inattentive negligence type accident, and there's a hit, but the person panics or whatever and flees, and so at that point, the running part of it might not be sufficient to connect all the dots back to the death and to elevate it to felony murder. Is that kind of where we are?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think depending on the facts and the hypothetical, we don't have that single unbroken narrative the way that we have here. Maybe they're stopping, maybe they're not, maybe they're scared, these kind of things. And also I think it bears noting that the defendant talks about, well, the felony wasn't complete until she failed to come back. The felony was complete when she left the scene. Whether or not you came back may give you a certain amount of grace with the police officer or with the prosecutor, but the hit-and-run felony is complete when she left the scene here without rendering any aid to the victim.
While he was, according to her, bleeding to death.
Yes.
That's pretty strong causation.
Yes, Your Honor. And the cause of his fatal injuries was her direct act, which was an element of the hit-and-run offense, an act in furtherance of that hit-and-run offense. The code section talks about the death occurring in the prosecution of the felony. The felony was ongoing at the time the victim was fatally injured. This is a case where the victim's death falls squarely within the res geste of the underlying offense. I'd like to briefly, the defendant also argues that to be an appropriate predicate of an underlying felony homicide case, we have to prove the felony was inherently dangerous. This court has not adopted that standard, but even if you were to adopt it, certainly hit and run is an inherently dangerous felony because death or serious bodily injury is contemplated by the statute itself. And again, if that were not the case, when we're talking about imputing malice to a defendant's actions, this felony was accomplished in a factually dangerous way. To contrast with Your Honor's hit-and-run hypothetical from earlier, a distracted driver or a deer, there's a collision. Here we have the defendant striking the victim, who is a pedestrian, with an SUV, which is a deadly weapon, with sufficient force to fracture his pelvis, to break his ribs, to cause this significant internal bleeding. Knowing that he is fatally injured, flees the scene. This was a felony that was accomplished in a factually dangerous way. And this court should not have reservations about imputing malice under these circumstances, as we statutorily do in these kind of felony homicide cases. I would reiterate again, as the court has noted, that the res gestae analysis is highly fact-sensitive. This court in Haskell talked about where that chain of events breaks, the chain of events is broken is a matter for the fact finder. The fact finder is looking at these underlying criminal matters, looking at the facts of the case, and where that criminal enterprise ends in Haskell was a matter for the fact finder. I would submit that where it begins is also a fact-intensive issue that was decided by the trial court in this case, subject to pretrial motions, and the trial court issued a letter opinion. And I think this court should accept the trial court's conclusion in that regard and find that this homicide was within the res gestae of the felony offense.
I have a challenge for you. This is, in some respects, a difficult question for me to pose to you. We said the killing must be within the res gestae of the predicate felony or so closely related to the felony in time, place, and causal connection as to make it part of the same criminal enterprise. What did we mean when we had or?
Well, Your Honor, I can tell you, I think it's been interpreted in two different ways if you look at some of the Court of Appeals case law. So, obviously, the court could have meant within the res gestae, in other words, that it's so closely related in time, place, and manner of circumstance, et cetera, or it could mean that these are separate tests. I think when we borrow the term res gestae from the hearsay cases, it's kind of an amorphous doctrine, right? Like the things that happen that accompany a statement can come into evidence. The things surrounding this underlying felony, it may be that the court was trying to provide a more definite definition. I would respectfully submit that you are in a better position than I am to make that conclusion.
Always difficult to ask a lawyer what we meant.
I can tell you, Your Honor, that I believe that lower courts have taken it both ways. If you look at the Court of Appeals opinions on the matter.
All right.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, I'd ask you to affirm the Court of Appeals and the City of Virginia Beach Circuit Court. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Sachs, you have a minute 45 left.
My answer to the Chief Justice's question was you did not mean this case when you described that. This is a difficult case. There's a lot of loose language. It's hard to find the standard. What concerns me is that maybe it's almost a judicial admission, the Commonwealth charges an accidental death, yet it sounds like the Commonwealth is relying upon evidence of an alleged intentional act. So it's confusing. Their position, their theory, judicially in the trial court, was it was accidental contrary to the intention of the parties. And that's what I think we're bound by.
As you point out, though, the causation problem is not the hit. Our causation problem is the run. And the whole res gestae doctrine, as I understand it,
yes,
is to legally impute true imputation,
yes,
without any overt evidence,
right,
malice to a certain death that occurred. So at the time of the run, she leaves a man who she says is bleeding to death, and she's the sole cause of him bleeding to death. What's unjust about the law saying that's pretty strong reckless disregard for human life, particularly since you're the cause of him bleeding to death? You just run away, tell nobody.
And I don't, what you say, Your Honor, makes sense, but it sounds like an expansion beyond what the standards are and what the statute is and how we've interpreted it. I mean, we're glossing something in that isn't there, and I suppose this court has the right to expand it. And that would be my second quick point. I only have 15. This is going to be a very significant expansion, I'd submit, of this statute, and will open up many, many doors. And if that's to be done, it needs to be done on a record that's clear. Lastly, I think there's some notice, some due process issues, policy considerations. We can't even determine what does this statute mean? How are prosecutors and citizens going to know what the conduct is that's prescribed? Time is up. I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.